You're listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on Thursday, April 13th, with Los Angeles-based guitarist and composer Michael Pissarro. A leading figure of the international Wandelweiser Collective, Pissarro is known for pieces of long duration with periods of silence. However, in the past 15 years, his work has branched out in many directions, including work with field recordings, electronics, improvisation, and various types of large ensembles. On this evening, he appeared as a soloist, performing his work Transparent City 2 for electric guitar and pre-recorded accompaniment. We began the evening, however, with a wide-ranging conversation that touched on various topics, including the meaning of experimental music, silence, field recordings, and his teaching career at California Institute of the Arts. Let's listen now to my conversation with Michael Pissarro at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
So it's great that we could have you here. I guess largely owing to the fact that you're on a sabbatical or a creative, what did you call it? A creative leave?
Creative leave, yeah.
Right. So you're on the faculty at CalArts. You've been there for how many years now?
15.
15 years. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Sixteen.
Mm-hmm. And what is, ostensibly you're teaching composition, but is there, what is, you know, it's been years since, you know, I was there years ago, so I don't know how the programs have morphed or what they're called, but what is the, you know, what is the program, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, we're, the place where I teach, we basically design the classes we teach, so what I'm going to talk about is what I teach. And just about any of us who teach some kind of music there would give you their version of the classes that they put together. Mm-hmm. So mainly I teach experimental music, which always seems like it's a contradiction in terms, because sort of the history of experimental music is a kind of autodidactic kind of tradition. And it's partially about that, about how people invent music from their own resources, what knowledge they have, but that doesn't necessarily fit a mold that exists already. But it's also kind of a word for the American experimental tradition, which goes pretty deep back into the 19th century, but most people associate it with Ives and then with Cage and so forth. And it's, so that's essentially how I describe what I teach.
Experimental music.
And I'll say a little bit more about it because I don't think that kind of music is actually taught very often in colleges or institutes or universities. And part of it is what I just said about this kind of autodidact nature. But another part of it is that it's never fit well in the academic tradition, and you cannot, I don't think, really teach that music in the way that you might teach a repertoire in which people can learn analysis or facts about something. So that history, which we could go into as much detail as anybody wants, really involves playing the music. So a lot of what I do involves working with students on repertoire from the experimental tradition or from ways of improvising. And I think that what's clear to me, at least, is that there's a performance practice involved with that music. I remember once, about 30 years ago, I was in Germany and I heard a group, which I will not name for a reason which is about to be obvious, that played Variation 7 of John Cage, which is a very open score. It involves, like they all do, graphic realization that you derive sound from. And I swear to you that the group sounded like a bad Mahavishnu orchestra. and I couldn't quite figure out how any, you know, and they were, I will say this about the group, they were a very well-known new music group that had played Cage's music before.
Right.
So it wasn't as if they didn't know what other music by Cage, that it was more fully realizable or more, that where it's easier to realize. It's not that they didn't know how that sounded. It's just that they looked at this score that had this apparently open context and said, and thought, oh, it's open. And so we can do basically anything that we think follows the rules, regardless of what we know about that world. On some level, it's okay. I can't imagine that Cage would have liked it, but I also can't imagine, because they were very serious about it, that he would have been sort of deliberately disruptive. But to anybody who loves that music, it just didn't, there's no way you would have thought
right.
that was John Cage's music if you didn't know, if you hadn't read the title of the program. So I, not just from that, but a lot of experiences, I thought, oh, maybe you can actually teach that. In other words, maybe there's something to be learned from playing a lot of that repertoire and starting to learn the kinds of limits that are never printed or right. really even spoken always, but that you kind of pick up. So I kind of view that as a lot of what I teach.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're talking about Cage specifically. I mean, that it's hard to not discuss or even think about experimental music without thinking about John Cage. But does
right.
this idea that you just kind of sketched out, does that extend to all music that's so-called experimental? Or is this just the Cagean version of it, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've come to think that there are like three layers to this word experimental. And there's the kind of record store layer or the casual one. It just means anything that doesn't fit anywhere else.
Okay.
I think that's often how it's used. Then there's this, what we were just talking about, a kind of American experimental tradition. It's no longer exclusively American by any means, but at least those things I started talking about mostly happened here. And Cage defined experimental music in a few articles. But then I think it's actually also a process, and this is part of Cage's definition. And the idea of the process is that, or it understands it, that music, it tries to understand something about the nature of musical change and the fact that it doesn't happen by accumulating knowledge. And then we take all this knowledge and we make a new music. It happens through trying things out that you don't know how they're going to come out.
Right.
And you look deliberately for areas in which you think there isn't a lot of knowledge, that is provable facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you look at this broadest definition of experimental, there's a lot of music you would call experimental that isn't. And there's a lot of music that is called experimental music that doesn't fit that paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And so one example that I like is to think about, so I hope this doesn't seem too esoteric, but in the 12th century, I know that already sounds really esoteric, so there was a school in northern Spain that was in a monastery that was trying to figure out how to put two voices together at the same time.
Right.
A bit like alchemy, for you know, since most music before that was essentially conceived of as a single voice, a
right.
singer. And the idea was that you could maybe figure out a way to have two voices sing at the same time, not the same thing, and that there could be laws for this.
Right.
But this predates a lot of musical notation. And so it seemed for a long time that there were scores that you couldn't read. Nobody knew what that music actually sounded like.
The music of this 12th century.
12th century monastery in right. Compostela.
Right.
And for the longest time, it was kind of indecipherable, or if it was decipherable, it was super dissonant music, which nobody could believe. And I had a very good friend when I was teaching at Northwestern who was a musicologist, and he found out, I don't know how many people, you know, because it's all debatable, but he practiced a kind of experimental musicology. Mm-hmm. But he found out that if you applied rhythmic modes, which were like poetic, iambic pentameter and so forth,
right.
the poetic meters that people had already known about, there were rhythmic modes derived from these. If you applied these to this music, mm-hmm. it made perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And so you have to imagine from the standpoint of the 12th century, people have no idea how to put two voices together, and they project both a consonants and dissonance or harmonic system and a rhythmic system, and they learn how to do it, but it cannot be notated. That is experimental music,
right.
In my book.
Sure. Well, that reminds me of, you know, other sort of early, maybe, certainly later than 12th century, but early contrapuntal traditions. I mean, even Bach, you know, some of the approaches to counterpoint that were, you know, fairly widely practiced. Certainly, it's been remarked that, you know, some of these strategies of you know, different types of invertible counterpoint, different kinds of rounds, all these sort of, you know, using a kind of firmus in different ways as being sort of somewhat experimental in the same way that you're describing.
Yeah,
it's kind of process-oriented.
And it's in a way, it's also kind of pre-linguistic or pre-notation. That's part of the point I'm trying to make about this, is that a lot of people use notation in all kinds of different music, but notation is often a very good representation of what we know about how to describe what instruments do.
Right.
And one of the interesting things about experimental music, as I'm trying to talk about it, is that you can't really draw a clear line between what's composed and what's improvised. Mm-hmm. You can't draw a clear line between what seems to be under the authority of the leader of the group or the composer or whatever, and what's a boundary that the musician discovers in performance, in which they're suddenly responsible for what they're doing and under the aegis of the composer. But in the end, we start to think, oh, but that's David Tudor as much as that's John Cage.
Right.
And we somehow know that. We somehow know, yeah, he wouldn't have been able to do this without Cage, but also Cage wouldn't have been able to do that without Tudor.
Right.
And there's no way of like, in the musical language, there's no real way to describe what goes on there. At that time, I mean, now, sort of 50 years afterwards, people work very hard to try to describe that. But what people are trying to do now, I think, if they're engaged with this process, is going to be somewhere else, but have a similar kind of ambiguity to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, good. Well, I let me just double back a moment. You were so the narrative of experimental American experimental music, I should say. What? Tell me more about this 19th century antecedents. Maybe I don't know about these. I mean, certainly we think of Ives as being the kind of the beginning. But what? Tell us more. Tell us what preceded that?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm the most knowledgeable about that history, to be honest with you.
I see.
But a lot of what I do know kind of comes from reading Henry Cowell and thinking about the sources of American music. But I mean, probably the most famous one, and it goes way before the 19th century, is William Billings, who worked with shape notes, as you probably know.
Right.
And we might put him in like the early Baroque, late Renaissance, and it's clear that he had some awareness of that music, but at the same time, being on American soil with that background, totally made the means of making that music different, which meant that a lot of people couldn't read music. And so a kind of system had to be created that allowed people in churches in New England in the 17th century and 18th century to read this, it's still going on, by the way,
to read the shape note
tradition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it just changed a lot in the music, including the harmony. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about its origins in this pragmatism and the fact that pragmatically, it you know, the pragmatic needs of making the music change the way the music was made. I think if you really want to go to something that looks like the beginning, that's where you go. William Brooks has a really good book on this, actually, that deals with Billings, Ives, and then Cage.
That's it.
And I think probably the best way to think about this in the American tradition, and again, I don't think of it as at all an exclusively American music, is to think that there is a sense in which American experimental music is informed by pragmatism. I mean, that even applies to Cage. He can seem very unpragmatic, but kind of deliberately unpragmatic. But there's a good friend of mine, a lot of people who are here know, Jenny Gottschalk, who wrote a book on recent experimental music. And a lot of her earlier work was on William James. And she draws all kinds of parallels between William James and Alvin Lucier, for instance.
That makes sense. Okay. Well, so tell us a little bit more of the broader context. I mean, I certainly still think of the main driver of this so-called experimental music as being a decidedly American practice, I guess, if not tradition, which maybe it's becoming now. But tell us more. I mean, where else do we see experimental music in this way? I mean, certainly now, in contemporary times, I can imagine that it's, you know, the impetus of Cage and this experiment has broadened to have practitioners everywhere. But are there other traditions that maybe we don't know about or I don't know about that have a longer historical line that are experimental in this way?
Yeah, I'm sure I don't know everyone, but for me a really clear one would be the sort of the what grew out of Tokyo, in the Tokyo musicians. In, you know, there's a kind of free jazz tradition in Japanese music from the 1970s, but then you had a generation that began to become known in the 1990s and on up through today, who I believe, I mean, a lot of these names people here will know, like Otomo Yoshida, Taku Shimamoto, and Sachiko M, and people like that, who I think of as having a very consciously experimental music attitude. I don't find it all that indebted to European music either. I mean, there are certainly, you can always find elements. I mean, we could talk all day about the influences of Japanese culture on Cage, for instance. So you're always going to find elements that don't just belong to a single culture. Right. But what happened there, what's still happening there in a way, is independent from that world. It's not like, of course, a lot of these people know about Cage and the experimental America, but I don't think that music is heavily indebted to it. But it's a music I would, and most people, I think, would identify as experimental music quite legitimately.
Sure. You know? Right, but I think of that, I mean, I guess that is it has been going on for a long time, but I still think of that as more contemporary. A contemporary form, certainly post World War II.
I don't think it's important to get too wrapped up in the taxonomy, but I think one interesting aspect of this music is that it really began as an improvised music. And there's a tremendous discipline to it, which can look like composed music, but there's also a sense of how the moment plays into that music that isn't really present in some of the parallels that we might, you know, some of the contemporaries of that group that were playing in other parts of the world who were composing music rather than improvising it. So I think in a way it's kind of important to keep track of like things that are a tradition where you can literally say, like in my case, I'm very conscious basically all the time of the things I've stolen or borrowed, sometimes with permission from like Christian Wolff or Lucier or whatever. So for me, that's very much a kind of a thing of a tradition where you've thought a lot about somebody else's music and you continue to work with it. Sure. But then there's this idea of the process, and that I think will instantiate itself differently in different groups of people in different cultures.
The process being finding an untested way of making music, in a sense,
that's not based on anything, basically knowledge,
anything known.
So
certainly improvisation, you've mentioned it many times. I mean that typically is one way to push this button, right?
It can be a way. Well, it can also be a way of repeating yourself.
Sure.
I mean, that's one of the things for me that makes the whole idea so interesting, is that it really doesn't fit. If you really think about this notion of experimental music, it doesn't really fit other musical, or it sort of cuts across musical categories. Mm-hmm. So certainly there are improvisers, people like Keith Rowe, who I think of as, well, he's an experimental musician still, and he would never consider himself a composer. I think he takes a lot of pride in not being a composer. But there's there are other improvisers. Again, I would not begin to name names because it's always a judgment call, who you feel like, I don't think they're doing, even trying to do something new.
Well,
they're
actually
working with materials that they know already, and that's perfectly legitimate, but it's not necessarily experimental music in my book.
I understand. Right. Well, there's a lot of the boundaries are fuzzy, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
that's
so
right.
In the context of, well, let's talk about, let's just go to your work. I mean, so to what extent, certainly I assume most, if not all of your work, you would consider experimental, in that, you know, there are investigations into areas that you don't know what's going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. To a large extent.
Yeah, where I want to find out what will happen.
Right, and to what extent does improvisation play a role, either in the composing, if that's what the piece is, how the piece is realized, or in the realization, or I mean, what role does this play in improvisation?
Yeah, so I definitely have an interest in improvisation and do it. And as a lot of people know, I also write music, even notes occasionally, and like even bar lines occasionally, and some time signature sometimes. I think the thing that really fascinates me is, in both cases, so in a case where I'm not playing from a score, where you could say I'm improvising, or when I've written a score and either me or somebody else is playing it, is something that I wouldn't categorize as either composition or improvisation. Hmm. It has something to do with the contingent opportunities of that moment, mm-hmm. given the limitations that you've set. Because even improvisers set themselves limitations. This is one of the main things I think I learned from Christian Wolff's music, which is a composed music that in most cases can never be played the same way twice.
Right.
And because the way in which a lot of it is composed is, it doesn't, especially when you're playing with other musicians, it doesn't allow you to retrace steps that you had before, because it's dependent upon decisions that other musicians make.
Right.
And you can't make them make the same decisions again.
Right.
And so you're in a different place. And so you're in a situation where you're playing a score and you know what you think you should do, but you have this other information that is utterly unique to that moment that you have to respond to in order to play that score.
Right.
I honestly don't know what you call that. You know, but it is, there are elements of improvisation in that, mm-hmm. Because you have to invent a way to respond to that situation. Mm-hmm. But it's also something in which you're also given instructions about how to do that, you know.
Well, speaking of Christian Wolff, I mean, my experience with his music is, at least the work that you're describing, it's music that sets up really a dynamic. I mean, there's musical material, but more importantly, there's a set of relationships and a dynamic among performers that has a built-in unpredictability, I guess, because of the instructions and the particular rules that the piece might have, right? So,
right.
So that's how you can have a situation where you can't play it the same way twice. But that, so that's, I think of that more as a kind of a social phenomenon, really.
Absolutely.
In his case.
Yeah.
And how people interact socially and in the moment. So is that an aspect of your work?
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I think that this the social element you're talking about, that's absolutely true in the case of this music. And the society that Christian is mainly concerned with is in fact the musicians playing the music.
Right.
And I think that, and then an audience that has done that, it's a very interesting thing for me, an audience that has done that before with his music stands in a very different relationship to a performance than an audience that doesn't know that that's happening. Sure. And I've done things where I've had to perform his music for a large group, and I thought, we're going to do a very simple Christian Wolf piece that the whole audience has to sing and do before we even play. Because I feel like you have to kind of know something about the decision-making process. Cage, on the other hand, and I will say the Vondelweiser composers that I'm very good friends with and associated with, I think have a, although these things can coexist very easily, right, have another notion of how the social aspect of the music could work. And that really involves listening. Mm-hmm. And I think that the situation that fascinates me, or the social situation that fascinates me, is something like this, where you have basically however many people there are in this room, each perspective contributes in some way to the performance, mm-hmm, without it being an obvious kind of participation, but derives from the fact that each person strikes their own attitude towards what they're listening to, or they're asked to create, to participate creatively as listeners, mm-hmm, by the music, not through any kind of, not some form of instruction or somebody grabbing your ears or something, but the music itself seems to say, well, the only way this situation is going to be enjoyable for you is if you begin to participate.
As a listener.
As a listener, right. Yeah. And the thing about that is that you're giving over a lot of agency for the character, the performance, to the people that are there in that situation.
Okay, but if I understand what you just said, I mean, the character of it is largely in each listener's experience. Is that right?
That's so where it starts.
It starts, and then where does it go from there? I mean,
yeah, that's a good. That's one of the things that I'm always in the process of finding out. Mm-hmm. But having worked with silence as a musical material for a long time,
yes,
that for me it's kind of a crystal clear situation of this, where if you've done performances that involve silences or situations that require really quiet behavior, in a sense, of the
right.
audience,
sure.
You begin to feel that every audience as a social group is different.
I see.
You know, so that it becomes a collective thing at the same time, even if it begins individually.
Right. So I think I understand what you're describing. I mean, I've experienced some of this myself. So,
yeah.
So you're talking about an experience, an event where you're, you know, a piece, be it perhaps in this Vondelweiser tradition or style, where there's a lot of silence, and so there's a kind of maybe an atmosphere maybe some kind of ineffable sort of group mind that emerges. Is this kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something you can clearly describe, but it's something you feel or
yeah. I mean,
okay,
it's
that's what we're talking about.
I would
about.
Say that it even has an affect. So if we think about affects as those things that touch us that in different ways, then I had a great experience of this about a year and a half ago. I have this quite long piece that has it's mostly sound, but 4 minutes in the middle are silent. And it was done on the Melbourne Festival, and there are 100 musicians involved, mm-hmm, and quite a large audience because it's this big city festival. So usually 300 or 400 people, or 300 people, let's say, at each performance. And it was done 4 nights in a row.
Right.
And so those silences on each of those 4 minute silences on each of the four nights were completely different.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as if one was noisier or there were more people kind of making whatever sounds they made in their
right.
chairs. It was just, it felt different.
It had a different feeling, a different character.
Yeah, and you would have to say at those moments that, yeah, a different character, a different affect, that group was making that affect.
Sure.
You know, we obviously, the whole situation begins to channel it in some kind of direction because that 4 minute silence is preceded by 35 minutes of sound, and it's not just any sounds.
Right.
But even given that you have the kind of the same, more or less the same music preceding it, this sense of this affect was different each night. And I think that's always there, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think we're not very attuned to it. You know, often performers are. You know, you can talk to pianists who tour and they're playing Schubert sonatas in 20 different cities in the world, and they'll know, or they'll have some sense of this audience or that audience.
Right. Right.
But it's not usually an experience that audiences themselves are very conscious of, or in which the overall consciousness of this affect is given much weight, you know.
But this is an extraordinary affect. It's not just, you know, a different audience vibe at a Schubert sonata. I mean, this is a moment that the kind of moment you're describing is a moment that doesn't really happen ever in most people's lives, whether in a concert hall or otherwise, where suddenly, you know, the sort of everything is just kind of suspended.
Right.
So it brings up a whole kind of all kinds of things in different people. So I guess there's a lot flying around. Whether you can, you know, pinpoint what it is. It's something's happening.
Yeah, and even the same person is not this, you know, that comes back to the performance two nights later is not the same person.
Right.
And they don't feel the same way about doing that activity at that time either.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, one of the things that I hope carries over is that even in music that has sounds, mm-hmm. this characteristic exists. You know, mm-hmm. so you don't, a silence is a kind of an extreme case where we really can focus on that, but this idea of like the fact that that's even there when the performers are active is something to think about.
Right. Okay. Well, good. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Wandelweiser. I mean, this is at least in the past something you've been very involved with. I assume still, identify as a Wandelweiser composer, or
I don't know what it means, but I still do.
Right. Well, it means a lot of what you've been talking about. Yeah. I assume. But
I've written about it one time. That was originally published on the Erstwerd site. And that's a pretty good shot at me trying to describe what I think Wandelweiser is.
Right.
One thing about that is that it's now like 8 years ago and we're all 8 years older, even older.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I would say about that for me, and I think it's different for me than it might be for people who know nothing or little about it, is that it's largely a group of friends that I just continue to work with regardless of, and be interested in regardless of how different our music has become.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for a lot of people, let's say in Europe, who know Wandelweiser for 20 years now, there would be people, especially in the German-speaking world, who find some of the really noisy and loud pieces I do now absolutely the opposite of Wandelweiser.
Right.
In their minds, it's just, it would never occur to them. But for me, you know, Antoine Berger and Jürg Fry are still amongst my best friends, you know, so I don't disown that at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, conversely, I mean, have some of these new works been disowned by Wandelweiser advocates?
I've been called on the carpet for making loud sounds.
So clearly there are certain orthodoxies associated with Wandelweiser. I mean, I guess quiet is one of them. Although I've come to learn that that's never actually been, you know, an absolute even from the beginning.
Yeah, we had no Bill of Rights or anything like that.
Right, but that's been the general drift.
Yeah.
And a lot of silence has been. But I guess in your work, I mean, there's an awful lot of it. You've been very prolific, and so there's a lot of different threads you're pursuing. But it seems to me, what I've been following recently, there seems to be a lot of denser pieces, a lot of, I mean, these field recordings. Pieces seem to be more and more. I don't know the chronology for you, but it seems more prominent in your work is integrating field recordings with instruments and other sounds.
That's getting to be 12 or 13 years that I've been doing that. I will say that I first started making field recordings in the late 80s, and I never dreamed at that point that they would be pieces.
Hmm.
I was doing it for myself.
Right.
And you had, I think at that point, you basically had the one Luc Ferrari piece, that was had a field recording right. along the seaside, which I didn't know at the time even. And so it never occurred to me. But at some point, after the years of doing this, it occurred to me that I was recording silences. And then the next thing I understood about that is that silences are incredibly dense mm-hmm. for me. In other words, the experience of silence at first seems like a withdrawal, because it is a withdrawal of the performed part of the music. Mm-hmm. But then once you begin to focus on any environment, you're actually talking about thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of sound sources. They're not all very present. I mean, in a room like this, it would be hard to find them, but I guarantee you, if you sat in this room for a couple hours with nothing happening, you'd be intimate with all kinds of things coming in from the windows and from all around.
Sure.
And so any quote-unquote silence is going to have, I think, a kind of sonic density. So I don't actually see silence and density as being opposed. I see them as being part of the, more or less part of the same same thing.
But it's kind of more of a scaling thing, I mean, depending on where, how close you're looking at something or how close you're listening, right?
Right.
I mean, when you strip everything, then silence, you know, can become a dense thing as you start focusing as if with a microscope, in
yeah.
a sense, right?
Okay. But it's also a part of the history of Western music, you know, so if you think about, it's not always the case, I mean, we still have marching bands and everything, for better or worse, but we have, my son played marching bands for 4 years and loved every minute of it, so I can't be too critical.
Right.
But but most Western classical music, it happens indoors, and concert halls were designed to shut out the external
sure.
sounds.
Yes.
And this already says an awful lot about the relationship of the environment to the music that we make. And I think that has a lot to do with what you're talking about.
Right.
So that we kind of come to expect when we hear music that those things will be minimized.
Mm-hmm.
And it could well be that our ears are, they're minimized more out of behavior and habit than they really are out of our perception. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I have no firsthand experience of this, but if you can imagine being a human at the state where you were being pursued actively by predators at all times, non-human predators,
right.
Your listening skills must have been unbelievably acute.
Sure.
Because you can hear through things. You know, you can hear through things that you can't see through. You can hear through.
Well, we still have those abilities.
Yeah.
We don't use them as readily, but they're there. I mean, we certainly have some. Most of us, anyway, I think, just inherently have good listening skills. I guess echolocation.
Echolocation.
We have
yeah.
pretty remarkable. You know. So.
Yeah.
Right. Well. Well, but back to your pieces of that. So when you're some of these pieces that I've been hearing, where you have a, you know, an instrumental part or some kind of musical element, but then a field recording just sort of appear. I'm thinking, for example, of some of the piano works that are on this recent collection of piano works. So some of those seem to have. It's almost as if the field recording is just kind of messing with the piano music in some way, or just interacting, seeing what happens. Is that what are you investigating there when you introduce some other physical space, sonic space, into what's otherwise a piano recording?
It's a good question. I mean, part of it stems from what we were talking about, is a kind of reminder to our ears
mm-hmm.
that we're already in an environment.
Right.
So the thing that when you play back an environment, it kind of begs that question of the environment that you're in.
Sure.
You know, so there's a kind of cleavage between
okay.
them.
Okay, so it's reintroducing your real environment into your listening environment. So it's mixing
like
them up a little bit. Well, I was listening just recently to this recording that you did with Graham Lamkin. And there was the vibrating cell phone recording.
Right.
You know, I was
that
like, wait a minute, where's my phone? So this is the same kind of phenomenon you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is kind of breaking the boundaries and reminding the listener, literally,
yeah.
while listening to your CD, that you're listening
and the moment,
in an environment that has other sounds.
The moment you're talking about is pretty amazing to me, too, because I had sent Graham this piano recording that I had made, and his way of introducing his own input was that cell phone.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know how many people think about this, but it's at that moment that you think, wait, who's listening? 'Cause I'm listening to the recording, but clearly whoever owns that cell phone is also listening to this recording. You know? Okay. Because it directly interrupts, you know, you certainly can hear it as a kind of like collage. But one of the things that fascinates me, I mean, it's a different topic, but might as well, since you raised it, and it's a good one for me, I like to think about it, is when you work with other musicians, is the whole question of, like, the persona of who's involved and who's listening kind of goes up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the case of working with Graham, or really in any of these kind of collaborative projects I do, I love the fact that we begin to forget that who the author is. And this is another thing that affects our listening, because
mm-hmm.
we like, especially people who listen to composed music, mm-hmm. like to ascribe the affective things to the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And even though most musicians know that's wrong, basically, you know, that there's an element of truth to that, but that if the composer isn't performing, and maybe even if they are, they're not, you know, they're not the only one there making the music. Quite obviously,
mm-hmm.
but this ascription becomes very hard in those cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so of course I know that that was Graham's phone.
Right.
But any listener might begin, knowing that this is a duo, might begin to think this, the far more important question, who's listening?
Mm-hmm.
And where are they listening? And that's, yeah, of course, on a recording, that's a great topic for a recording, I think.
Right, well, it certainly threw me for a loop, but it's, yeah, well, I totally get what you're saying. Just, I mean, we're always hearing these, I mean, I guess there's field recordings going on all the time.
Absolutely.
So you're just kind of bringing that into focus by fading a field recording into your piano piece or whichever.
Yeah.
But, okay, well, excellent. Well, all right, well, we could go on and on. Certainly, but we do have some music to listen to tonight, so let's talk a little bit about that. So
and that was my conversation with guitarist and composer Michael Pissarro on Thursday, April 13th. The evening continued with a solo performance of Transparent City 2 for electric guitar and pre-recorded accompaniment. And we'll conclude our broadcast with an excerpt from that performance. Here now is Michael Pissarro performing his own Transparent City 2 at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.